Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight's one of those nights where I feel like recording. I'm not exactly sure what to cover. I do keep a giant list of subjects, but, you know, if those were easy, I would have already recorded them. Sometimes I find the best success that I have is relative to just calming my mind and mulling over the day's experience or the week's experience, and then just looking at any emotion that I've had predominantly throughout the week that is unresolved. Because one of the things I try to do in the show, you know, is get at the things that we're all thinking about but no one's talking about, and then reflect on it and think about it. I'm going to give you a little gem out of my own life, just in case any of you are dealing with this or have dealt with this, either successfully or unsuccessfully. By the way, if any of you who are able to listen to what I'm saying and then you're like, oh, I totally conquered that, really need you to report in. I need your information. Other people need your information. So this might be a real interesting little topic here. This is a very personal one for me to share with you. I think a lot of you will probably have deduced, if you're a longtime listener, that the regiment that I have to keep personally in my life to do the things that I do, including this show, are fairly intense. I had an episode way back in season one, I think it's episode 14, that is called Being Intense. And that episode actually forged itself out of a relationship I was in 4 years ago, which was a great relationship, but this person I was dating was like, God damn, like, why do you have to be so intense all the time? And what's funny about it is I don't see myself as intense. What I see myself doing is discussing issues that interest me, and they're not trivial topics. Because trivial things for me, as probably are the same for you, it just gets to be small talk. You know, it gets to be what you would talk about at the water cooler. It's talking about how the weather is a particular way. And there's nothing wrong with having those conversations, but they have very limited lifespans, right? You know, how many times can you go in a loop about something before you need to peel off and change the subject? And I don't know about you, man, but I'm trying to get all of the good stuff while I'm here. It's an interesting thing. I mean, what's fascinating about it is when I talk to my friends and I say, well, do you remember something you did in, say, 2009? Oh, yeah, I just moved into this place. I just got that car you see out there. Or I did this, or I got this belt buckle, whatever it is. And I say, well, how long ago does that seem to you? Oh, it seems like yesterday. Okay. So time is moving. And the older you get, the more it speeds up. And I'm going to give you a little secret on how the brain works. Because the brain erases patterns. The brain erases cliches. How many times have you driven to work and then you get to work and you're like, I can't even remember any part of that drive? You ever drive to work and or drive someplace through residential and you think, did I run a red light? I could have run a red light. You know, maybe real late at night when there's no cars helping you cue your brain to, okay, everyone else has stopped, I'm going to stop. But it's real late at night and you just go all the way home and you're like, oh my God, I don't even remember that. I mean, I kind of do, but I don't. It's because your brain is bored to death and it erases big giant chunks of your life because it's like, we don't need this. We don't need another memory of driving from point A to point B when you do it every single day. Why does time speed up when you get older? I think potentially it's because your mind is erasing useless patterns. I watch television at this time of day. I get up. I brush my teeth. I do this. I do that. I talk about the same boring shit every single day. And so your life is being erased because you've turned it into a trivial machine, a trivial pattern. If you want to really feel life, change it. Change it. I don't mean run off and divorce your partner and, you know, leave your kids behind. I don't mean anything crazy like that. Do something with those people that you never done before. Explain this phenomenon to them. But I've done these episodes about, you know, excellence, you know, perfecting things and really putting in the polish, making something really special. If you're a carpenter, I'm going to tell you, as soon as you get done with whatever the hell you built, for as much time as it took you to build it, spend twice as much doing something else to it to polish it and make it even better. Polish it, varnish it, embroider the thing with carvings and amazing things, whatever it is. If you cook a meal, well, maybe presentation is everything this time around. Maybe instead of throwing it all on the table at once and going, have at it, guys, you bring it out in a 5-course meal simply because there's 5 things to eat. Whatever it is, change it up, improve it, experiment, and watch how your genetics literally activate mutant genes for you to accomplish amazing things. So what this episode's going to be about, and I'm not exactly sure what to call it, is when you make your life balanced with this perfection mechanism, with this perhaps what you might entitle as this intense nature. You know, if you were to be a person who's never exercised, you've never run in your life, and then for some reason, you either gain interest in doing that sort of thing, or for whatever reason life changes and you have to do that thing to survive, you know how it goes. For the first several days, maybe a couple weeks, you think you're going to die. And all of a sudden, your body just clicks. And the mutant gene activates and you're okay. I guarantee every kid that goes through basic training is puking their guts out at some point and thinking, what have I done? This is crazy. I can't do this. And then a week or two or three in, man, they're just like, oh my God, I've got this. I can run several miles a day. I can do 1,000 push-ups or whatever it is. As I share my life with others, it's interesting. If I share my life with, say, people at a smoke lounge, it's easy. I show up when I'm ready. I spend as much time there as I want, and then I go back home. If I want to share my life with someone on a more personal level, then it gets a little tougher. Because the way I work is 24 hours all the time. Now, does that, I go to smoke lounges, I relax. I do bring my computer from time to time. The amount of screenwriting I've done at a smoke lounge is pretty impressive. I've written a lot on this patio as well. But there's certain things that you just do all the time because your brain's always churning. I have a dictaphone. I talk into it all the time. For my screenwriting, for my project updates. Sometimes I just need to work something out. But I've realized that there are some interesting epiphanies with this regiment. Now, I have close relationships with people that understand this, and they have the same lifestyle. And so we can spend days together, and we're in our own little circles, even though we're spending time together. And so it works out. We spend time together such that we have the human presence of each other. And when we break for food, we integrate food with entertainment. As we eat, we watch something on Netflix, HBO, whatever. Then we spend some personal time together. Then we go back to our lives. But any time you take your dollar bill, which is your day, your 100 cents that you're going to spend on your day, your ecosystem, and you're spending that money on your productivity and your social input and your entertainment. It's interesting how we spend our dollars differently. Now, when you move in with someone and you share a personal life, you end up harmonizing over time how you spend your money. And you're going to spend some of your money on your partner's interests, and they're going to spend some money on your interests, and they're not always what you would do with your money, but that's what love is all about. But I've been through enough experiences in my life, and this part of this theme is sort of covered in the friendship episode, and that's a funny episode because no one really wants to watch that. They think it's some Tenacious D song. But what it's about is there's different levels of friendship, and I think it is extremely important for you to realize the difference between a friend, an acquaintance, a best friend, and know that your parents are none of those. Your parents are far more special if you have a relationship with them, right? Some of you don't, and you'll have a different person that's your parent. You know, you have your step-parent or your grandparent or just some person you know who behaves like your parent. So I'm talking about that person, that special person in your life. That's a parental guardian and a beautiful guide in life. But they're more special than all your friends and your besties and all that stuff. It's a very heavy trend to say that your parent is your best friend. And I know people that's definitely the case, but in my book, as taught by a very good friend of mine who's a brilliant screenwriter and famous director, he was telling me about, again, I've mentioned this once before, he had a conversation with his child, and at one point, he made it a point to tell his child, "I'm not your best friend, man. I'm not your friend. I'm your father." And that's way more special than any of those people. You know why? Because those people are going to come and they're going to go. And you're going to have things you can do to them to lose your friendship and lose your love between each other. And you and I will always love you no matter what. I will always be here for you no matter what. And that's what makes me your father. Obviously, the same is true about the mother. When you pop out of that realm and you go into your personal relationships, there's this whole thing about frequencies that we talk about all the time. And what I find very, very interesting is whether or not one can maintain a circle of influence when you're completely different than that influence. Now, again, friends are beautiful because friends, you spend your time together and then you go back to your realm. And typically speaking, you spend more time in your realm than in your friend's realm. And that's why friends are wonderful. You can have guys and gals that you know that you marvel over what they do with their life because you won't do that with your life. Either they're more productive than you, they're less productive than you, they're crazy, fun, wild people. Maybe some people are self-destructive and moany-groany. But you get to kind of visit that and get a feel of it and take off. Sometimes you visit people to get inspiration. And then you go off and try to do something with that inspiration. In a personal relationship circle, it can be very challenging to determine whether or not that's possible. For those of you who are in your 20s, well, you have a lot of time left to mold your opinions about what you want. When you get in your 30s, well, you're starting to figure out what makes you tick, hopefully. And your choices are very specific. I like this. This is why I do this. I gain a beautiful emotion from this. When you get in your 40s, now you've most definitely made decisions about why you like yourself. And it probably, if you lived a normal life, those of you in your 50s, 60s, and above who listen to this show, please share whether or not there's a delta for 50, 60, 70, or is it 40, you know, you're pretty much satisfied with who you are and you keep that to your death? I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty dynamic, so I don't know if I'm a good use case personally. But there's nothing like finding balance with yourself and being happy with yourself. And then you fall in love with someone who's different than you. Like, maybe really different than you. And so now you're kind of going, oh, geez, do I compromise myself for this other person? Maybe they're compromising for me. And usually if you're a good person, you know, or a smart person, you know you can't change other people. You don't want to go that route because it just doesn't work. I don't care how old you are. changing someone else is really rough. It can't come from you. It's got to come from them. They have to be influenced by you. And they make the decision themselves. And then because they're not you, they're going to probably need some assistance if they really wanted to copy you. And you don't want some single white female situation, right? The person's absolutely mocking you, dressing like you, being like you, and they don't really understand the fundamental platform as to why that might be good or bad. If I had stayed in the Midwest, I probably would not have been able to make this episode because I would have adopted the average mean of my hometown, which is a wonderful frequency to live in, trust me. No criticism whatsoever. But since I came to the entertainment capital of the world, Los Angeles, I think that's a safe thing to say. And I chose to participate in this world. You start to see, or I started to see, the difference between working for corporate America, average Joe stuff, to working in video game companies where we are cranking out magic every 18 to 36 months. We are supposed to impress the most unimpressionable minds with the most amazing thing. Plus, we're trying to impress ourselves. So everyone's working around the clock to try and figure out how to make a machine do something it's not meant to do. And it's every element of that game. It's the story. It's the video game engine, the art, the sound, the voiceover, everything, the graphics, all of it. Later in life, I got into the film business through various means. And, I have not been on, like Avatar productions or anything massive like that. My participation has been in the writing realm, the film incubation realm, the industrial design realm, working with Sid Mead and watching what he's done, serving these people, serving with these people, doing my own thing. And so you see the burden of filmmaking. I've had, the privilege of sitting next to giants and watching them just crank out one amazing thing after another. I mean, being in Sid Mead's realm for 20 years, going to his house and him saying, "Oh, I just worked on Elysium. Ah, I just worked on, this film, that film, this film." And it's mind-blowing. Just hits a home run every single time. Even Tomorrowland, which he designed, the look of Tomorrowland, no one contests that the thing doesn't look amazing. They just didn't like the story. The music business. Getting extremely close to that and seeing how these amazing multi-platinum album, band members work together, don't work together. Poor folks that have had their lead singers commit suicide and they're trying to keep the band going 20 years later. Gut-wrenching stuff, seeing the prices that they paid, hearing all the stories of the things that are never going to be written down on paper, ever. Getting into screenwriting, I'll tell you what, for every, I shouldn't say this because I don't even think this is the case. Screenwriting is a really hard thing for your family and friends to understand. As much as people want to read things because they think it's going to be great, they just don't have the patience. It's a weird format to read in. Some people love it. Very few people love it. It's a tough business, and there are tons of people that will tell you who have been in it. It's almost like they went into a spook house that was too gory, too scary, and they came out and they just have white. They're just white, and they're just staring 60,000 feet in the distance, and they're saying, "Don't go in there. Whatever you do, don't go in there." And these aren't trivial people coming out with those cautions. And so I've had to weather through brilliant people telling me, "I don't think you want to get in this business. I don't think you want to do this." And I've got to listen and respect their opinions and then keep going. When you have stories in you that need to be told, because no one's ever told those stories before, and they are groundbreaking to the mind, you got to do it. Forget everybody else. Mozart was 100 years after Bach. I mean, what if he didn't have his crazy dad pushing him into music, but he still wanted to get in music, and people were like, don't get into classical music, man. It's been around for 100 years. We would have lost out on the emotional evolution of classical music. I'm giving you these examples because I'm setting up a platform to jump off on. The purpose of this episode. Let me give you this one last example before we start getting into the actual formal discussion of it all. If you were going, let's say you live a fairly normal life. You got a 9-to-5 job. It's a great job. You love it. Making good money. You're single. But you, for whatever reason, you're in this circle of celebrities. Doesn't have to be any particular type of celebrity. But you fall in love with someone that is mega famous, mega successful, and maybe not famous like, you know, again, like some household name, but famous for what they do. And you get to know them and you're like, wow, this person really cranks out the stuff. Male or female, doesn't matter. Maybe it's a female singer and she writes her own music and writes her own lyrics, but even if she doesn't do that, she's working around the clock. She's got tours constantly being incubated, everything. Choreographers that teach her and her dancers how to do it, and just goes on and on and on. Stage design, costume design, got to change your look, got to change your sound, keeping up with the trends. Maybe it's a famous filmmaker. Someone who's been tasked with directing the next Star Wars or something, you know, and it's just massive pressure. But you're falling in love with this person, and they seem to be falling in love with you. Now, I'm assuming that most people listening to the sound of my voice will say, I would expect that my life is going to have to change to maintain their life. Because what they do is visibly and obviously intense. It doesn't mean they don't laugh every single day. All day long. Maybe that's what they do. Maybe they're comedians. Maybe they write comedy. Maybe they direct comedies or whatever it is. So it's not like it's intense in a negative, humdrum kind of way. But if you want to get in that person's circle, for me personally, if I ever met someone who was like that, I would be dating some woman who's super duper engaged. She could be a businesswoman. Some sort of super hot Martha Stewart, right? Okay, I know that what I am doing does not require as, well, maybe my life, but if I was in a more traditional lifestyle, I would know that their lifestyle is more intense than mine, and I'm going to have to surrender first. You know, I'm integrating my life with theirs. They're not integrating theirs with mine as much, because they can't afford to. If they were to take out a certain chunk of time that they normally spend doing something else, they're going to lose their game. And one great example was Johnny Carson. He did a show 5 nights a week, recorded it during the day, aired it in the evening, but this guy has to develop a show. He has a ton of famous people coming in. They have plenty of other press appearances and promos they're doing, so it's rough. And then they pre-scripted all those interviews. Generally, this is what this person is going to be talking about. If they had a comedian on, like George Carlin or something, George has got a bit that's worked out, and he tells Johnny, ask me this, ask me that, ask me this, and I'm going to just lead into the next joke, and then you'll have a blast. Maybe Johnny doesn't even know what the guy's going to say, but he realizes, you know, oh, I heard you've been in California lately. You know, would you go to the amusement parks? And then, boom, George jumps into his amusement park thing. They're so heavily scripted today, it just hurts the soul to watch this stuff. I used to think it was all just completely ad-lib. Haha. Well, Johnny's life was not a mystery. He was a tough man to marry. Tough man to spend his time with, because he was constantly busy. By the time the weekend comes around, he just wants to chill, man. He wants to go out in his boat, catch a little sun. Sure, he'd leave and go on vacation and someone would guest host for him, but you know, his ability to calm down was probably really tough. Jay Leno talked about it as well. Jay was smart. Jay got out before he lost his entire life to the show. Now he's having a blast. Usually in a family, back in my childhood, there was sort of this pre-balance expected to happen. The father would get up and go earn the single income household salary that the house needed. The mother would usually have children, and so she would have her day job, which was the most important job of the entire family, which is raising the children to hopefully be nice human beings. Now, you go back 20 years before I was born, and the fathers were very stoic, often, and very non-emotional, and so they were sort of the odd man out. People always had weird, loose relationships with their fathers and very close relationships with their mothers. And it's just almost unanimous with my own family and the stories I've heard about, you know, how close were you to Grandpa? How close were you to Dad? And it was always, well, Grandpa was kind of always just working and doing his thing. He'd come home tired, and then he would watch his TV show, and he'd go to bed. But Mom, all kinds of stories. Ah, we did crafts. She took me to the park, and da-da-da-da. But now a woman is forced to work. And again, I got nothing wrong with that. When I was a kid, every woman worked too. They just cut out about 10 years to have whatever kids they were going to have. Most families in my hometown, I think, had at least two. Every once in a while, they'd knock out a third. And there was the anomaly where the family would have eight. But those were pretty rare. And there was usually a farm involved. They had tasks that need to be done by the entire family. What I want to get at here in this episode is, if you are one of these intense people with a really intense job, and your spouse is not involved with your job, which happens, and that's amazing. I've got a fairly close friend of mine whose wife is a magician with him, and I won't name any names, but we have another member of the Deep Thoughts family who has the exact same situation. I think that's just beyond cool. When you can be an ice skater and your wife is your ice skating partner, I mean, that's just awesome. But imagine being a magician with your wife, and hopefully you're really successful. I mean, does it get any better than that? Maybe there's some drawbacks with it I'm unaware of, but my other buddy I know really well. I shot a pilot with him. His Facebook posts are just the world I want to live in. You know, it's great. But if you're one of us mortal men who, or women who have that intense nature, and you're trying to find a partner, and you're running up against this episode's for us. How do you integrate? How important is it to be careful with who you lead on, because you need to check stuff out. Now, when I was in my 20s, I want to say I do apologize for talking about my life so much, because for me, it almost makes me want to throw up when I start getting into that type of conversation, because it's it seems grandiose and it seems boasty, and I'm not trying to go there at all. In one way, this show is therapy for me to be able to even talk about that sort of thing, because when I'm by myself, when I'm not on the show and I'm with my friends, it only comes up if someone needs an example of something, you know. But my 20s were awesome. I mean, I did all kinds of wild shit, but I remember telling my friends, because they would come up to me, and I dated almost solid through my 20s, somebody. But people would ask me, like, well, how's it going? How's your love life going, or whatever? And I'd say, have you found anyone interesting? And I would say, well, sort of. I said, my problem is they always find me interesting, and I don't necessarily find them interesting. And that's that weird phenomenon, because when they would come to my house, there was always like, it was like a studio of a bunch of stuff. You know, it was like, okay, those are my paintings over there that I'm working on. I'm about to sell that one. Da, da, da. Here's my music studio. Here's all the music I'm working on. here's what I do at work. This is my software company here, and blah, blah, blah. So it was just like, it was sort of like a little Willy Wonka's factory inside. And so who's not in their 20s going to be impressed with someone in their 20s? Now, I thought I was fairly normal for living my life to the fullest. And then when I finally started seeing the reactions on people's faces, I was like, why is that so intense? Like, I remember bringing over my buddy and his girlfriend. He was a musician, of sorts. He brought up his girlfriend, and because he wanted to start making music with me. And so I said, well, let me show you what I'm working on. And I played a few heavy duty club tracks I was writing at the time, all these wild samples in it. And I just hit stop on the playhead, and this girl goes, man, I don't even see how you people can do that. Something like that. I was like, what are you talking about? She goes, well, you're one of those people that can make that kind of music. And it's like, I only pay to see people like that. And I'm like, oh, weird. I'm just a normal guy that makes music. That's all it is. But in my brain, I'm thinking, okay, I got to acknowledge this person for their epiphany or their feeling they're having. I don't want to disagree with them or piss on their parade or whatever. And so it started dawning on me slowly through reactions of other people. This must be what's going on with my girlfriends as well, or my potential girlfriends. And I was never a scammer, you know. I wasn't like, there's some guys that would build up a bag of tricks and then use it to sleep with people, right? You know, I'm going to impress you. I'm going to show you the 1-2-3 thing, and then you're going to be jello in my hands, and then boom, we're going to get in the sack, and then I'm going to see you later sort of thing. I was never that guy. But as I get older, I'm finding out that it matters. Everything matters. And for me, I'm very fortunate. I'm very comfortable with myself. I'm very cool. So, I mean, I feel cool with myself, you know, working on my projects and that sort of thing. But I'm like anyone, you know. I dig sharing my life with someone. It's my favorite thing to do. I love entertaining on one level. So when I'm with someone, I'm like, I created this thing. I'm going to read you my latest film. And I wrote this one first versus those other 15 ones I've got treatments for because I thought you would dig this. And sometimes that really works out great. My last film is done really well that way. When I used to do music, I'd write songs about the girls I was dating. And they loved it. And I loved it too. It was like, hey, this is never going to hit the airwaves. I'm never going to push it that intense. But you got this little gem. You can listen to it whenever. In the friendship episode, I talked about the very specific nature of the frequencies of other people that you have around you. And that there's this weird phenomenon in your 20s where you're all sort of finding your path. And some of us find our path very astutely, and you know, maybe you don't keep it for the rest of your life, but at least you sort of know, again, the theme of your life. I'm going to be an entertainer, whether I write film or make a video game or write a book or make a website or a YouTube show, whatever it is. I love the interaction between people. Now, this show is not, hopefully it's entertainment on one level, but hopefully it goes way deeper than that. But when you hit your 30s, everyone starts to make decisions about what they're going to do with their life in terms of companionship. So people get married, people have kids, and those are big decisions, and they're huge commitments, and you lose that track you have with your buddies where, you know, you're going to clubs or you're role-playing or whatever you're doing where you just can spend 12 hours with your buddies. Like when I was in my 20s, especially before my daughter was born, we would go into Electronic Arts where we worked and play a game for 14 hours, as I mentioned recently. You can't do that anymore when you got a wife and kids, unless you're able to convince your wife that she gets another 14 hours off the next day. You're trading. So then when you cross over that threshold of partnership and having children, then you resync with your friends who made the same decision. Hey, you want to go to Disneyland with the kids? Yeah, let's do that, man. It's all right. Or, nah, shit's too expensive. Let's go to Knott's Berry Farm instead. Okay. Hey, how about an RV? You know, if you got an RV, we could both go out in the desert together. Beautiful thing about my neighborhood, I think it's sort of shitty and it's good at all at the same time. We've got at least three families that all decided to buy RVs together. And then they bought their trailers and their motorcycles and jet skis, and they planned their trips together. It's probably like, I don't know, 10 people. And then there's people on the street who don't have that piece of equipment or whatever, but they fall in their cars, and then they all share the amenities, and maybe they bring the food or something. I'm not quite sure. I haven't gone out with them. But I think that's awesome. They've resynced in their 30s, 40s, and early 50s. But that's on a more macro level. Maybe one of the ways I can actually bring this episode to you is to suggest, if you are younger, or you're about to jump off that diving board of a rather intense endeavor, you're going to pick a career or a pastime or whatever, it's going to require that you really hunker down. We need to manage that with our partners very openly. I love technology. I love it. I love building things. I like electronics. I like code. I love code. And so I'm always interested in pushing the envelope with whatever's out there. But that means I have to constantly learn what's out there. For instance, I'll give you a real-world example. This is a little geek thing for you. There's a 3D product out there that's free. It's phenomenal. It's called Blender 3D. You'll hear me mention it every once in a while. The current version is 2.7. Well, they are feverishly working on 2.8. And 2.8 is a complete paradigm upgrade to this product. It is, for what I get out of the betas, it looks phenomenal. And so I'm excited. I think Blender 3D 2.8 and above is going to take over several roles that have been exclusively held by products like 3D Studio Max and Maya. And so I personally have this goal to get in, because I'm really good with 2.7 and I want to be even better at 2.8. The 2.8 has amazing features that we all can use. So I'm already planning my projects. I've contacted some friends of mine who are designers for interior design. And I've said, look, you know how you got those things in SketchUp or CAD? They look like shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I want you to export that into a file format that I can, you know, OBJ file. And I want to import that in and light it for you and surface it for you, because I'll give it to you for free. But I want to be an expert at this, because I can make, you know, $5,000 every 2 weeks off this process. There's a little business for you in case you're interested. Free product. You can make $10,000 a month. Just get good at it. With art, there's a lot of design out there. A lot of most print designers sort of just look at the playbook on the internet and go, oh yeah, I know how to do that. And they just copy. But then there's people like me that'll go in there, and I've got all this information architecture background. I've graduated from Edward Tufte's class twice, and I just know how to move information in a way that you can assimilate it much quicker. But it's in a most, to a print artist that went to school with all the rules, it's atypical of how their brain works. But the user gets it and goes, oh my God, this was so easy. I'm like, yeah, it's because some of us think differently. They were trained by Sid Mead. That's why we think differently. So in order to have a life where you are going to get the most out of it, you're literally squeezing that chamois, and then you're folding it in half, and you're squeezing it again and again and again. Every drop of water is falling out of this thing, such that when you unfold it, it's like almost dry. That's the life I'm trying to live. That's the life I do live. But then you have to manage the circles of influence that you allow into your life. You need someone, like I said several times in previous episodes, it's not the kind of food you eat that makes you compatible with someone. It's not necessarily how you believe in God that makes you compatible with someone. It's what is your purpose in life? What are the themes that you wake up most inspired to engage in? That is who you are, and that is who they are, and you need to make sure that the two of you can at least agree on several different themes. You know, it's not a mystery when people say that depressing people will always drag you down. They'll never drag you up. And so if you're with someone who's chronically depressed for whatever reason, you can give it your best shot, but once you've tried all the bags, tricks in your bag, and they're just fully committed to being depressed, it's time to cut them loose, let them live on their own, figure it out, decide whether or not they want to make a change that might make their life better. But don't be surprised if nothing changes and they just live that life of complete suffering. And I will say, I mean, I want to make a point here because I don't think I've ever said it clearly. There are some families and some cultures that raise their children inside of envelopes of suffering. Backstories about their heritage that makes it all suffering and suffering and suffering. That is probably one of the greatest crimes and one of the biggest IQ tests of a particular society to do to their children. There is absolutely no benefit to that whatsoever, to feel punished. And I think that that is something that's being cleared up a little bit in our era. Sometimes it's a racial thing. Sometimes it's just a time and place thing. You're in the wrong place. You know, I was never raised with that situation, so I was able to see the brightness of the world constantly and not constantly look for the negativity, as much as I might talk about a conspiracy that frustrates me. You're never going to create light if you've been built from darkness. You're never going to own your own mind if your mind has always been, you know, chain linked to some horrible event that you didn't experience at all. My grandmother grew up in the Depression, and she talked about the Depression from time to time, but she never, ever brought the family down as a matter of doing it. She tried to establish the fact that we live in a better world, but to make sure we appreciated it, because there was a time when food and money and survival was extremely tough, and she made huge sacrifices for a whole, you know, 15 years as a result of it. And then a world war started up, you know, towards the last 5 years. If you are on the verge of doing something amazing, or if you have finally figured out a machine for your life, you get up, you eat certain meals, you go to certain places, you don't drink too much, you don't do drugs too much because that interferes with your ability to accomplish your goal, or whatever it is. I dated someone who went to concerts about 5 times a week. And as much as that's amazing, and I got to meet the artists behind the backstage, and, you know, those are memories that I'll never regret whatsoever. The problem was, is that I was constantly in the audience when I'm a person that's always on stage. And so my dreams were being paused because I was dating someone that didn't have any. Or at least whatever they had, it could be done in the 9-to-5 time frame, which is fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with these people whatsoever at all. It's just when you choose to be the other side of the game, it can be daunting. And, you know, I've got friends of mine that are, you know, very famous musicians, and they had the benefit of being super famous from, say, maybe 18 to 35, probably 18 to 30 is the main thrust of their career. But, you know, there's plenty of fans that want to hear musicians play, but they have a natural cycle of retirement where they don't have to go on world tours for, you know, 10 months out of the year. I mean, I feel sorry for bands like Aerosmith and Rolling Stones, where, I mean, I know that they probably don't agree with me personally, but To have a situation where you've got to go on these incredible, grueling tours simply to have the thing that you love the most in life occur is intense. Remember Michael Jackson said, if I could just live on stage, I would live on stage because that is where I am in my element. That's where I feel the most love in my life, So even a super duper famous musician has an end. A super famous athlete has an end. And maybe they go off to be a news announcer or whatever, and they have that second tier of their life. Maybe they become a painter or something. But here's what's interesting and sort of fascinating, I think, for the average person. If I personally choose to maintain screenwriting, personally, as my love of life until the day I die, I will potentially live a more intense life than my good buddy who's got 5 platinum albums and he's pretty much retired at this point. Because my endeavor will not end until I die. I'll die at a keyboard somewhere or a dictation device of some kind. That's why I liked these 20 years I've had with Sid Mead, because he's always creating something. He can't stop creating things. A guy like Da Vinci doesn't have an end. He just keeps going. And why? Because it's his nature. And that's something you need to recognize. It's a full lifespan dedication. And, you know, who knows what I'm personally going to do, whether I'm going to write so many films, get them, so many of them made or whatever, sell them at least, and then I feel comfortable. I can retire. I've got enough money in the bank or whatever the case might be. Maybe I fall in love with sitting on the beach in Hawaii. Maybe that's what I fall in love with, or Huntington Beach. It's a beautiful place here, let me tell you. But as you plan your life and as you take people into your life, these are things that you have to know about yourself as you're spending that dollar of the economy of your day. Do you have time for other people? And if you do, how much time? And when do you have that time? There's 24 hours in a day, which is how we subdivide a week. 60 minutes in an hour, you feel me? So as crazy as it might sound, you might be able to pull off sort of a makeshift methodology of managing your week and your day and your month and your year and all that stuff. But eventually it might catch up with you. I always find it catches up with me. If I don't plan it, then I get out of balance. If you're a creator, what'll end up happening is you will feel like your children are being suffocated. They're being jailed, and you must keep going. Prince was a great example. That guy, he always said he thought of his songs as his children, which I thought was sort of a kind of a weird metaphor. But as I grew up and did my own things, I was like, yeah, I know what you're talking about, dude. And what it does to you is that as you traverse life, and especially if you're someone like myself where you have a huge list, a list that is way too large of things that you're intimately interested in experiencing, discovering. One of the toughest things you can do in your life is say, you know what? I really wanted to do that, but I have conceded I never will. Or at least right now, it's not going to happen. Maybe it happens in the future. But for instance, like me and music, I had to put it aside at one point. I don't know if I told this story a long time ago, but I had a studio that I built like every kid in the 90s, and I was making money off of it. And I just wrote every single day I possibly could. And, you know, I lost a bunch of it when OS 9 erased my hard drive with about 500 songs on it. Now, if I could even get to the songs that I've got on a zip drive, which has a password, for some damn reason I couldn't remember what the password was, and I only had like 4 passwords in my life. The product that I wrote the music in has been made for 25 years, and so there's no way to get to the soundtracks at this point. I've got a bunch of cassettes all over my house. But I had to give it up, and I gave it up right after I took my studio to the next level. I had taken my studio to, God, it was probably like a $50,000 studio when you really totaled up all the instruments at their full retail value. It was never worth that at the resale value. But I had blown up my studio, and then EA had this gigantic problem on their hands. AOL lied to EA, and this huge gaming network we built was built for 20 million users, but only had maybe 2. And they messed up the whole protocol building games. And so it was just a cluster at the end, and they laid off 4,000 people. And so in the end, I found myself unemployed. I had a pretty good chunk of cash in the bank, but I wasn't paying attention to music, because music is something you do when you don't have life breathing down your neck going, you better get a job, brother, because you're used to making money. And now we're in this recession. So it was a problem. Plus, as a musician, who are you selling your music to? They're usually kids are the ones that are obsessed and living inside albums. For all the old timers your age, they're living in the big rock stars that already finished up their careers. And so they're listening to Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin or Motley Crue or whatever. They're not listening to your new stuff. Now, if you got to do it, you got to do it. If you got to do it, it's going to fall out of you. So make your music and you'll find an audience. And I, you know, with SoundCloud and iTunes being very accessible to sell music and 100 other places, you really can just make a nice little album and put it out there. So it's always kind of alluring. But then you have to look at the ecosystem of your life and say, well, is there something else bigger and better that I can do with my skills right now that can reach more people? And that's where, for me, screenwriting is it. It is a beautiful world where you have a canvas and a methodology where you can tell stories to move souls. And you could target kids and you could target adults and you could target both of them. You can mix up the genres. You can do a horror movie or a love movie, you know, a romance, rom-com or something like that. Anything you can think of, you can do. Well, that's kind of nice. Now, music has the same freedom, except that in music, there is going to be a producer that goes, man, we don't want to lose money. And if we're going to promote you, you better make music that's sort of popular right now. Well, the beautiful thing about Netflix and Amazon Prime and HBO and all the other film studios and television networks, they know the game right now is throw it at the wall and see if it sticks. So it's a free domain. But back to the subject. Integrating people in your life when they're just good, normal people. Now, they say opposites attract. Okay, I agree, up to a level. Now, some people are great listeners and some people are big talkers. Guess who I'm more compatible with? So for years, I've known that if I'm going to date somebody, get intimate with someone, they need to be a really good listener because I talk incessantly. I try to make it interesting, of course. I'm always trying to split an atom of human existence. And if you think I'm bad on the show, talking for an hour, 2 hours about one thing, it happens in real life too. Now, I don't just sit around chatterboxing. As a matter of fact, sometimes I can just be as quiet as a church mouse while the person I'm with is just yammering on. And I mean in a good way, just talk, talk, talk. And then I feel like listening. I'm like, oh yeah, you take the mic. I just need to listen to somebody else. You got to know that about yourself. If relationships are having issues, you know, I don't hear this personally because the relationship issues I hear are the traditional cliche relationship issues. But usually motivation between two people is one of the biggest themes that breaks down relationships. He or she is lazy. I am always working. Because they're lazy, I take on too many tasks in the household. If you have children, one person's the predominant parent. And when you need help as a parent, they're not there because they're lazy. Now, maybe they have a reason for being lazy that you can all rationalize. Maybe the person's working, generating all the money, and so you're taking the other role. That's balance. But sometimes you're both working full jobs, and then one person just comes home and they're more exhausted. Maybe the other person's job is a job they hate. It's got a lot of mental trauma in it, maybe even physical trauma. And so they are physically and mentally exhausted when they come home. And what's the fix there? Well, it depends. If they're in a job they hate, then they need to change that job. It may not be overnight. Go see all my other episodes on that kind of stuff. But maybe they're George Lucas or somebody gigantic that's like, oh my God, you have no idea the burden I'm going on. I mean, imagine when that guy said he was going to make the next three Star Wars, 1, 2, and 3. You know, he had 20 years to write the scripts on it, of course. Huge pressure. Huge pressure. When they wanted to reboot the Star Wars after Disney bought it, imagine the pressure on every single person's soul to satisfy those customers. Having seen especially the first three episodes get absolutely, you know, ripped apart because everyone has their expectations of what those shows are going to have in them, how the characters are going to develop, who's going to be playing the roles of the characters. I mean, imagine you get the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi. And this guy's a legend, and you're going to play that character, and you are constrained by the dialogue that's been written for you, so you might even have a better way of expressing yourself as that character, but you're not allowed to. So sometimes people are exhausted for good reasons, and sometimes not so good reasons. It's no mystery to older people that when you marry early, you run into a lot of these things because you haven't fully formed yet. Oddly, though, when I was a kid, my whole hometown was made out of people that were married on average by the age of 22. 22 was considered kind of late. Between 18 and 20, almost every couple that was over 40 years old had been married in their teens. 18 or 19. And they managed to live their entire lives together, happily. They managed to succeed. They had lots of money in the bank. American dream worked. You did what you were told, and it worked. That doesn't work anymore, right? Because we've allowed ourselves to be taken over. Then, of course, and this doesn't happen for me because I've got a solid background in going after my dreams and making them occur. So if, when I meet people that, you know, never met me before and they want to be in my life, if I say I'm going to do something outrageous, they look at my background and they like, okay, well, you're one of those people that do those things. You're always doing those things. So I trust you, but I wouldn't trust other people who have never done it before. Or it'd be tougher for me to trust other people. So if this is the first time you're going to jump off and do something radical with your life, quote unquote, understand that people might not have previous efforts or previous history with you to trust that that would be the case. A lot of times people try everything and they fail, and that they create this false history that doesn't equal their future or equal their present. As Tony Robbins always says, your past doesn't equal your present. Very important. It is important that someone believes in you if they're going to be in your life. I've dated people, it's funny, I've dated people that have barely heard me sing. And they got me into a wedding of a bunch of rockers who have, again, tons of platinum albums. And I was one of many singers that got up to the stage and sang. I sang two songs. And for her, it was like, you can do this, man. You can do this. You're one of those people. I've seen you sing. I saw you make people in the room really happy. And I've seen worse than you, man. So get up there and do it. And I did it. I did it live with the live band. It wasn't karaoke, man. And it worked. And I will always thank this person for thrusting me into that, because now I know I can do it. But I've known other people who were intimate, that I was intimate with, you know, I had relationships with for many years, who saw me unequivocally go into rooms full of 50 people. I crank out a song, and it's karaoke, but I'll blow the room away and still have to hear this, you know, sort of cynical, well, that's just karaoke or whatever, just, you know, pissing on the parade on the way home. And I'm like, you didn't sing. Maybe you should go up and try it. And then when the whole room yells and screams, you'll feel like you've got something. And as long as you are honest with yourself and you surround yourself with tons of talent and you're not a person who BS's yourself, you'll know whether or not you have karaoke skills or whether or not you have real life skills. You know, oddly enough, the person that believed in me had a whole super mega history with music, knows every single famous person in music that is has ever been anyone, let's put it that way, and she believed in me, and it was amazing. The other person knows no one, knows nothing about writing music, and had the audacity to be cynical. It's weird. And that's why you have to pick the people in your life very carefully. And the closer you bring them into your circle, the more you have to be careful with who you're bringing into your circle. And that's why I think you have to be very careful as well with trivial reasons why you like people. You know, we don't like to talk about it, so I'm going to talk about it. This is sort of tough for me to say to you guys. At any one point in history, there's certain looks that are considered good-looking and certain looks that are not considered good looking. I've been very fortunate in my life to fall into the society thinks I'm good looking side of the equation. And there's an amazing thing that you find out about life that I think that people who find themselves in the unattractive realm, and it's sad that anybody believes that, it's BS. Everyone has a beauty to them that's amazing. It's really true. And confidence in who you are is, above all, your rating when it comes to whether or not you're attractive or not. Know that about yourself. I've seen beautiful people that think that they're ugly, and ugly people think that they're beautiful. And it's like, both of you are beautiful. Just chill out, you know? But in my life, because of my looks, I've been able to usually date anyone that I meet. I'm able to get into that realm and at least have a shot. Again, maybe I'm not interested in them and they're interested in me, but I'm the one that started it, so I try to finish it in a really gentlemanly manner. Try not to get too close too quick so that people don't get heartbroken and that kind of thing, because I get my heart broken too, believe me. I've had it just stomped out like a bad cigarette. And that was good for me. But what ends up happening if you're awake is that you find out that it doesn't matter what someone looks like on the outside at all. It really doesn't. When they speak, it is when you find the glory of God shining through a human being. And I say it very specifically like that because I'm always telling you that you're special and God wouldn't waste his time on you if you weren't. Why? Does God need another trivial being in the universe? Nah. Now, does that mean every fish in the sea is special? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe they play a role in the greater ecosystem that is the sea. Who knows? I've known some people that were amazingly attractive, that were hideous human beings. Doesn't mean they weren't special. It just means that whatever choices they made, they chose to sort of side on the side of selfishness and shallowness, and they judged other people in ways that no one should be judged. They missed the beauty of the world that they lived in because they were too busy being cynical. And karma bites them in the ass. If you want to have an area of life that karma absolutely works almost instantaneously, it's the acidically beautiful human being. And then there's people that have the weirdest, strangest looks, you know, according to all the doctrine of what is beautiful and what is not. And they're surrounded by beautiful people constantly because they are so interesting and so amazing. I don't believe there's any physical images of Socrates. But Socrates was known for being, and I'm just repeating what people said from his time, they said he was one of the most unattractive men ever. Isn't that fascinating? Because his contribution to philosophy and consciousness is the cornerstone of almost every Greek philosopher after his time. Isn't that phenomenal? And he had huge groups of students that would just come and sit with him as he would discuss things. He's probably the OG deep thoughts dude. When you're able to be with anyone that you have interest in, you get to evaluate humanity at a much faster pace, and you don't get swept away by things that are shallow, like beauty. And you're like, you know, there's that old saying, I'm going to make it nicer. And it's a saying, I don't know, it's about 20 years old in my lifespan, but it's a saying that no matter how beautiful a person is, there's always someone who's tired of going to bed with them. I don't think that's completely true, but if that's all they have, I guarantee you it's true. The bimbo, that's always aimed at women, but there's men bimbos too, right? I mean, whatever you call a guy that's got the same thing, he's just good looking, but he's just got a head full of rocks. And so there's limits to that. Now, maybe they're a sweetheart, and that's why you love them, because they're just really nice. They're always there for you, taking their shirt off their back for you, helping you do whatever you need to do. Those are good people. And I'm not saying anyone's a bad person, but again, as you form your life, and you're introducing human variables into your life. It's like an equation where you have all those letters, plus, minus, you know, divide by, and all this other stuff. It's A plus B times Z over X or whatever. All these people are in your life. And as you have children, they become part of your equation that will never go away, hopefully. If you are around genuine people, trust me. And I say this because when I went to Portland, Oregon once to see my buddy get married, I ran into some people that made it a point to take a crap on beautiful people. And, you know, I thought it was very interesting. Marilyn Manson, who I'm not, I think I would love to have a conversation with that guy because I think he's extremely intelligent. He said some extremely intelligent things and during interviews, and that fascinates me. He's obviously a guy, I think he's got his, definitely his good looks, you know, he's in that kind of interesting European realm of look, but he always treats himself like he's not good looking. He talks about how he was a kid, he was all beat up and, you know, made fun of. I can believe that occurring, I guess. But he made that song called The Beautiful People. It's one of my favorite songs he ever made. And it shook me for a second because I was thinking, oh my God, you're right. There's this perceived have and have nots of the beautiful people and everybody else. But I went to Portland, Oregon, and there was just this subliminal subtext to what people were talking about, hating on, you know, other people. When I was in the Bay Area, they hated on Los Angeles people like you couldn't believe. And it was one of those equations I mention every once in a while that Steve Jobs taught us all. These people don't have to lose for you to win. You're in your own realm. And if you have amazing people around you, the beauty of your face or whatever, your body, it all kind of dissolves. Being in the video game business, I would run into predominantly guys who were extremely introverted. They didn't exercise. They ate poorly. And they were talented because they were introverts and they managed to manifest their skills because of that appearance that they had. And they got off on things that people didn't get off on who were pretty people. And I've had this thing my entire life when I would go into, I don't do this anymore, but in the 90s, there was role-playing conventions that would come through town, the Bay Area, tons of them. Ones would be like Dungeons and Dragons conventions and other conventions. And you would go in and I would always be, you know, really trendy looking and blah, 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 right? You know, and when I would walk in the room, I would notice that these kids would get defensive. And then as soon as I treated them like normal human beings, instead of being one of these beautiful people that Marilyn Manson's talking about, where they're uppity and angry at, you know, or whatever, treating people less than themselves or whatever, I sat down with them and I would start talking about my role-playing experience, and it was as deep, if not deeper, than their own, and I was one of them. And they were like, oh my God, he's the cool guy that treats us like we're normal. But people that look like that guy typically are assholes, and they make fun of us. It's like, if you ever see the movie, not another teen movie, my God, it's rated R, very R. Brace yourself, okay? If you have a tender heart, don't watch it. But if you love all those 80s movies that we saw, the guy who's Captain America is one of the leading actors in it. They're introducing all the kids to the high school at the very beginning of the movie, and this guy's like, at this high school, we don't have any cliques. Either everybody's equal, whatever. And then he goes, okay, jocks, you go over there. Nerds, you go over there. Girls, you hot chicks, you come with me. He immediately splits everybody into cliques, thus making a joke. Being a computer whiz kid when I was young, I would go to the computer class, and all the geeks would just sort of like push me away until I got the highest score in the class, and I would treat them like normal human beings. I mentioned that whole thing because a lot of you are like that anyway, but it's this inclusive algorithm that is real, not this faux stuff we have coming out of certain political parties. You don't make a bunch of hate groups to create tolerance in the world. If you're trying to build the circle of your life with quality human beings, I try to keep it open constantly. I don't date women because they're beautiful. I date them because, or at least on the outside, I date them because they're beautiful on the inside. And that's where I have been the most successful. Now, sometimes they're beautiful as well. And you win both sides of the game. Their physical beauty is where you want it, whatever turns you on. But you got to get down into the deepness of who people are if you're going to hang on to your dreams at the same exact time. They must understand your dreams, and they must see your success as their own success. And I really wanted to do this episode for this particular reason. I'm talking about how to succeed all the time on your own, how to go get your dreams. But I haven't talked about that integration thing. It's real important. In the friendship episode, I talked about it because the friendship episode is really for you when you're younger, you're in your 20s, and you're trying to figure out, okay, how do I do this? How do I make sure I surround myself with the best people that aren't going to mess with my dreams? But you will find people, because I'm always telling you that you're just basically an older little kid. Those algorithms keep going your whole life. Now, what's interesting is, this is sort of a morbid reality when you get older. Let's say you're 22 years old and you have a lot of drinking buddies. They're your besties on the girl's side. And you're drinking, you're getting drunk, you're puking, and you just kind of laugh it off and you're thinking, well, we're doing this because we're young. And then you cross over your 40s. And you notice most people have calmed down out of that. They understand their liver's going to explode eventually. It's hard to have a job and kids and drive home if you're drunk. A couple DUIs and your whole family life's going to change, let me tell you. One DUI in California and your life will change. About $15,000 in fines, a year suspended on your license. Now, when you go apply for jobs, it'll come up on your background check. Your family and friends know, and they sort of know, all right, you know, there's part of your childhood that needs to go away. It has to go away. Otherwise, you're going to consume yourself to death. And very few people in this world want anyone to die of that stuff, let me tell you. So everyone's usually rooting for you. They'll help you. And that's just one example. One of the, this came up today in conversation. It's another way to look at your personal relationships. Let me give you this little analogy and I'll shut up. If you're forming a business and you're going to take on a partner, partnerships are probably the most difficult marriage you could possibly get into. And if anyone is telling you anything different, they are not very knowledgeable in the subject matter. I wrote a class once online. Don't even know where it is today. But I wrote about, I don't know, it was like 6 or 7 articles on it. But 2 of them were on partnerships. And it was after I came out of a really bad partnership situation. And it wasn't bad in terms of other people's really horrible stuff where people embezzle money and destroy the company and that kind of stuff. It wasn't horrible like that, but it definitely contributed to the demise of my company 3 or 4 years before it should have. In fact, my company should still exist. But what I tell people is if someone was a drinker and they were your partner and you go out with them, or sorry, they're not your partner yet, but you're considering that they're potentially a good partner, you're going to need to dig into that drinking to find out if they really have it under control. Find out what they do with their pastimes. Ask people, do you ever see this guy drunk? You know, when's the last time you ever seen him drunk? You ever seen him drunk? You need to know, because they might be a closet alcoholic, or maybe they're a budding alcoholic. If they have a marriage, you need to know how solid that marriage is. You and your wife get along? Why don't we go out and do like several dinners? Why don't you have me over for a picnic? I'll have you over for a picnic. Let's go on a vacation together for like 10 days. Because I need to see you get along with your partner for 10 days. Maybe even screw something up during the, that'd be a good movie, wouldn't it? Screw up something during the vacation just to see if they're going to break. By the way, here's a digression. When I saw, was it Party Crashers? When I saw Hangover 2, and at the very beginning of that movie, there was, this guy's getting married to this Asian girl. So the American guy's in Asia, and they're in this elevator, and they die. The guy dies in the elevator, and then their whole life goes to shit. The hangover two thing. They're going through this horrible thing. I immediately thought of, I thought I knew where the film was going at the end, and my ending is so much better than their ending, and it goes like this. All of the, just watch Hangover 2 again. When you get to that first scene, imagine if instead of it being what it turned out to be, which is everything was real, at the very end, the bride's father had created this complete facade to test the groom to see what kind of man he was, because he didn't like the groom. And so the guy's really not dead in the elevator. It's all a big setup. The whole thing has been completely set up. And at the end, he looks at the groom and he goes, "You passed the test. Now you can marry my daughter." That would have been a better ending to that movie. Just ask me, I'll write a better movie. So I give you the business analogy for this one reason. As you bring people into your life, you need to get into who they are. Find out where their stress levels are, what breaks them, what makes them, what makes them happy, what makes them sad. If you're not a very sensitive person, they can't be a very sensitive person either. It just doesn't work. I don't know how two super overly sensitive people get along. I would hate to see that. That might be a great Christopher Guest movie. I think you feel me. I mean, I wanted to get at this sort of adult-themed conversation. I just put out the Mr. Rogers episode 3 days ago. It's doing way better than I ever imagined it would do, which is great. I felt definitely his presence was on this patio when I was recording it, so maybe that's who I should give the credit to. When I saw Mr. Rogers go off and try to talk to adults, and he was asking them very poignant questions, and he was trying to dig down to a deeper level, and again, like I said in the episode, he realized that the hardened bias of mankind was interfering with his ability to communicate with them, it was sad. And so I feel like you guys are the crowd that he wanted to talk to. You're intellectual. You are open-minded. You know, I want to say how privileged I feel that any of you subscribe, that any of you watch the episodes, especially those diehard folks, because you're not trivial human beings. You're not watching this show because you're dumb. You're watching this show for the exact opposite reason. And then I think some of you watch the show as my mentor. You're watching the show sort of smiling at some of the things I say, going, "Oh, well, you're going to find out it's different than that. But okay, for now, you know, you do your thing. I'll leave a comment, see if I can't maybe get your mind to think a little bit different. But I understand you're a bullheaded dude, and you're going to think what you think, and that's it. But you're up there having had many of these experiences. You've solved these problems, and I appreciate your viewership. Trust me. You know, I do consume, and, you know, when I go home, I barely watch any YouTube that's serious. I'm watching funny, stupid stuff. You know, these cringe videos, I just like to watch stuff where I don't have to think. It's great. Just sort of that, you know, I'm just doing that while I'm going to bed, and then I fall asleep, right? When I go to my smoke lounge, as you guys always hear, I'm watching the most intense stuff the entire time I'm there, because the guy owns a place, he loves that stuff. He watches 12 hours of that stuff a day. We all have a joke. This dude's seen every video on YouTube twice. We'll go, "Oh, dude, have you seen this video?" And we'll, "Yeah, I've already seen it." You know, and we go in, he shows us cool stuff. And when he shows me really cool, lighthearted stuff, I put it on the website, you know. So there are people like Lionel Nation. I think the guy's an absolute genius, but he's always talking about current affairs and very acidic topics. And it's not because he's acidic. He is trying to give us perspective and intelligence on how to digest acidic things. Like I said, just recently, I'm trying to avoid that kind of stuff. And I'm trying to go at the metaphysical human experience that we're all dealing with, because there is no manual that's being written by anybody. I mean, there's plenty of self-help books and that kind of stuff, but on YouTube, I just don't find there to be stuff like this show. And so I feel like we're filling a gap for now. Now this, again, I could be wrong. There could be 20,000 channels out there that get really deep and better than me. It's therapeutic for me. Hopefully it's good for you as well. And hopefully you feel me in this episode. Here comes the outro. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. There's audio and video in case you want to switch feeds. There's a locked Facebook group, a Twitter page, a Patreon page in case you want to tip the show. Again, for all of you that stick on to any one of those forums, I super appreciate it. Hope I'm creating content that's entertaining. If there are issues that are metaphysical like this that just seem to come up in your life and you're like, oh, you know, literally, if you live an entire day and you've watched tons of these episodes and you're like, man, I got this freaking problem. If you don't want to share it in a public way that someone can see who you are and go, that's the guy with that thing, just get on a Facebook, private message me. There's even a private message system. There was, at least on YouTube. I don't know if it still exists. I think they got rid of it. But if that still exists, that exists. But then Facebook has its thing. Private message my DeepMind account. Let me know what's going on. All of your stuff is confidential. I mean, geez, for the people that I mention and give credit for shows, I barely remember who it is. So don't even sweat it. But I will do my best to address any of those issues through my own experience. And even if I haven't had the experience, I'll try to dig in my experience and my mind to figure out how maybe I didn't experience that. And then we can go at it from there. But anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.